thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
The Bible reading today is from Matthew 26, verses 26 to 30. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body." Then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink from this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives.
Thanks, Matt. Medwin, good evening. Good morning. It's been a long weekend already. It's good to have you here this morning. Trust that this is a good start for your long weekend, an opportunity to remember the events of this weekend, the death and resurrection of our Lord. Trust that you've got lots of other good things planned as well. I know that we do, a whole bunch of stuff going on. I hope it's not too busy. I hope you get some rest in the midst of all that's taking place as well. You probably remember the global financial crisis of 2008. Who could forget? The worst global financial crisis since the Great Depression. And after that took place, of course, there was no kind of end of the analysis of what had actually led to that, right? So every single talk show, every newspaper, every magazine was talking about the various causes that had gone into creating this financial crisis. But there were a few voices in the analysis that were given a little bit more credibility and a little bit more authority and weight. And those were the voices of those men and women, those professors and other economists who had not just been able to tell us why it had happened, but who had predicted that it would happen. And we still actually hear from them today. I don't know if you notice, every so often they'll introduce some economist, and part of the reason why we should listen to them is because they accurately predicted the global financial crisis. There's a credibility that goes with being able to look at what's happening and posit forward and be able to say, here's the result of this kind of this line. This is what's going to take place in the future. And it changes the nature of their credibility and what they are able to say and do. To some degree, we need to apply the same kind of principle to the account of Jesus' death that we find in Matthew's account. You see, Matthew is not writing about Jesus' death kind of after the event to try to explain it. It's not as if there's some sort of crisis that's taken place where then Matthew has tried to explain it and say, well, look, he's died, but here are all the reasons why. And the reason why we can't really look at it that way is because Jesus has predicted his death throughout the gospel. And that changes the nature of how we can understand his death. We can't look at Jesus' death as if it were just an accident, as if he were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. We can't see it as some sort of political misstep, as if Jesus had just not quite understood the political power dynamics in Jerusalem, or that he thought he had more support from the popular vote than he actually did, and that this was some sort of tragic political misstep. There's actually more going on here, because Jesus has told us beforehand that he is going to die. And as we looked at last week, Jesus tells us and tells his disciples that he is going to die. He predicts his death, his suffering, death, and resurrection on at least three occasions. But each time he doesn't actually tell us why he's going to die. We're just told that he is going to die. Each of the predictions of his death is followed not by discussion about the significance of his death, the meaning of his death, but actually a discussion about what it means to follow him. And so if we were reading the gospel for the first time, if this was the very first time we'd read it through, then we would be thinking and wondering to ourselves, by the time we get to Matthew 26, what the heck is actually going to take place? First of all, is Jesus right? Is he actually going to die? Or is it going to kind of all turn out right for him? And secondly, if he does die, why? What's the point? What's the significance? What's the meaning? Jesus has at this point in the gospel only given us one clue. He's referred to the fact that he has come to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's all we're told. A ransom for many. I'm not told exactly who the ransom's paid for or any of those sorts of things, only that it's a ransom of some description. It's not until we get then to chapter 26 that Jesus, for the first time, really elaborates on the significance and meaning of his death. And so that's why I want to have a look at the Last Supper. In your Bibles, Matthew chapter 26, verses 17 to 30 is where Jesus really begins to explain his death. And I want to try to pull a number of themes together, because typical of Jesus, he doesn't just kind of make it simple. He ends up pulling together four or five really big themes from the Old Testament and reinterpreting them in light of his death. So the background is this: Jesus and his disciples, along with pilgrims from all over the world, have descended upon Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. This is one of the oldest and most significant of the festivals of the life of Israel. Jerusalem would have been abuzz with people. And for the last week, Jesus and his disciples have been commuting. They've been staying in Bethany at night and then traveling the 3 kilometers into Jerusalem before returning each night. Each day, they've gone into the temple, and Jesus has been teaching in the courtyards. While he's been there, while he's been teaching, there's also been this growing antagonism between himself and the religious establishment, and it's gotten pretty intense. It actually ends with Jesus giving this really inflammatory speech, criticizing the hypocrisy of the religious establishment, and ultimately predicting the destruction of the temple. And not just the destruction of the building, but the passing into irrelevance of the whole temple institution. And so the religious leaders are looking for a chance to kill him. They hope to do it beyond the festival because everyone might riot. It's all pretty intense. And in this context, Jesus and his disciples celebrate the Passover together. You might recall, or you might not know this, but the Jewish day begins at sunset. And so in order to kind of make sure that all the pilgrims could celebrate Passover, many of them began at the very beginning of the Passover, which was the Thursday night. Jesus and his disciples are, to some degree, the first cab off the rank. They're celebrating it as early as they could. And the fact that Jesus chooses this festival as the kind of the time in which he ends up dying is not coincidence. There's something quite significant here. And so this is where we want to begin. And I hope that I'm able to explain these concepts simply enough. We're going to be drawing together some pretty big themes from the Old Testament to try to make some sense of what Jesus says here. So if you do have some questions, feel free to kind of hit me up afterwards about them if you'd like. So Jesus and his disciples are celebrating the Passover. And this festival, as I said, was one of the oldest of the Jewish people. And it marked the last of the plagues in Egypt when the angel of death passed over the land of Egypt and passed over the homes of the people of Israel who had the blood of the Passover lamb painted on their doorposts. This was their salvation. In fact, if you read through the Old Testament, you will often find this phrase: I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. It's this shorthand summary of all the good things of God. If you wanted to refer to every good thing that God had ever done, but you didn't want to tell everything that he had done, this was the shorthand. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. It was the definitive act of salvation. And so Jesus, right off the bat, seems to tie his death to this definitive act of salvation in the Old Testament. And that becomes a lot clearer when we actually get into the meal itself. If you have a look in verse 26, it says, while they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, take and eat, this is my body. He does the same with the cup. Now, when we have special meals, perhaps over this Easter weekend, you're going to go to somebody's house or have people around to your place for a special meal on Easter Sunday, which is great, but we tend not to have kind of symbolism attached to our meals, do we? We don't kind of pass around the salad of affliction and the bread of suffering and then the roast beef of joy. Like, that's not quite how it works for us. The symbolism is found in our gathering together at worship, and the meal might be a little bit more special than a normal meal, but it's just a meal. Passover, because it had been celebrated for centuries, actually contained a number of symbolic elements. And the unleavened bread that Jesus takes was representative of the speed of their departure. The people of Israel, when they left Egypt, had no time to allow the dough to rise, and so they'd put no yeast in it. So the flatbread actually had some significance. Jesus takes that symbol and gives it new meaning. And again, we're familiar with kind of the reappropriation of symbols, aren't we? Usually at Christmas, I'll have somebody say to me that the symbols of Christmas are actually pagan symbols. And that's not actually correct anymore. They may have once been pagan symbols, but Christians have taken them and given them new meaning, right? They have filled them with new meaning. And so they're no longer pagan symbols anymore. They may have once been, but their meaning has been changed. Jesus takes the symbolism of the Jewish Passover and changes the meaning. He says, "This is my body broken for you." That's an enormous shift of meaning. He does the same thing with one of the cups of wine. There were three or four cups of wine that were drunk during the Passover meal. He takes one of those and says, "This is my blood." And so Jesus wants us to understand, first of all, that just as the Passover was the definitive act of God's salvation in the past, his death and resurrection becomes the definitive act of salvation for those who place their faith in him. It's a pretty big start, isn't it? But there's more to it than just that. When Jesus takes the bread, he says he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples. And those four verbs, to take, to break, to give thanks, to break, and to give, are actually also found when Jesus feeds the 5,000. This is one of the most significant miracles in the gospel accounts. If you were to read all four gospels, you would find that there aren't very many stories that are told in all four. The feeding of the 5,000 is one of them. It seems to have held some particular significance for the early believers. And one of the things I think is most noteworthy about it is that Jesus, in that moment, provides for the crowd of people. 5,000 men, we're told, plus women, plus children who are gathered there. All Jesus has to work with is a handful of fish and a couple of loaves, and he takes bread, gives thanks, breaks it, and gives it to the disciples. And everyone ate, and everyone was satisfied. And here's, I think, the most important part. Jesus over-catered. They had more at the end than they had at the beginning. I think there's like 12 basketfuls of broken pieces left over, more than they started with. You might think, you know, if Jesus were really trying to prove that he was the Son of God, he would have catered precisely. That as the last person took the last morsel and the whole crowd said, "I couldn't eat another thing," then everyone would have said, "Wow, Jesus is indeed the Son of God." But I think it's more significant to note that his provision goes above and beyond that which was needed. His provision is not just enough for everybody, it goes beyond what is needed. This too, I think, is meant by Jesus to draw the disciples' minds to his own provision. This is not just a salvation, even just for the Jews, it's actually meant for a much broader audience. It's bound for more. All the way through Matthew's account, and we'll see this at the very end of his gospel, he makes references to the Gentiles, anyone who wasn't a Jew being brought in. Here we see a hint that his act of salvation is meant for more than just the Jewish people. That his provision is enough and more than enough for all who believe. But that's not all that Jesus does here. If you keep reading in verse 27, when he takes the cup, when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant." And here Jesus introduces yet another really big idea from the Old Testament, this idea of covenant. And to explain it in its simplest form, a covenant formalizes relationships. We might think about it in terms of contracts, where two individuals or two groups of individuals might decide to formalize their relationship. And there's terms and conditions, aren't there? Things that I will do on my behalf and things that you will do on your behalf as part of this formalized relationship. The covenant was a central concept in the Old Testament. The relationship between God and his people was a formalized relationship. It's summarized this way: "I will be your God and you will be my people." In other words, simplest form, God will do the sorts of things that gods are supposed to do. He will protect, he will provide for, he will guide and lead. And the people will be marked as his. They will value the things that he values, prioritize the things he prioritizes. They will be identifiable as his people. I will be their God, they will be my people. The full expression of the terms and conditions of this relationship are found in the law. And as we looked at a number of weeks ago, when Jesus talks about the law, he talks about the purpose and function of the law. And the purpose and function of the law is not actually to provide a list of do's and don'ts. The purpose and function of the law is actually to promote lawlessness. Right? The law is meant to describe for us a portrait of the good life. And as we appreciate and understand that good life, we internalize it and no longer need the law. I use the example of a seatbelt regulations. Currently, it's a law on the books that we ought to use a seatbelt whenever we drive, right? I have now, I don't know about you, but I have become lawless in relationship to the seatbelt regulation. Not because I refuse to put my seatbelt on, but because I don't even think about it anymore. I get in the car, I put my seatbelt on. I no longer need the regulation on the books. They could repeal the law tomorrow. And guess what I would do the day after when I got into my car? I would put on my seatbelt. Because putting on your seatbelt describes the safe driving life, doesn't it? The story of the people of Israel was that they were never able to internalize the law of God. It was always external to them. They never wanted to do it. And so they failed to be faithful to it time and time and time again. And so the long history of the Old Testament is God entering into this relationship and his people refusing to kind of take it on board, breaking the terms and conditions, which led not only to condemnation, but also eventually to this extraordinary promise. If you have your Bibles, you might want to look in Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah has spent a great deal of his ministry speaking about the failure of the people to live up to the covenant expectations. But here in chapter 31, he speaks of a new covenant. Listen to these words, starting in verse 31 of chapter 31 of Jeremiah. "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with them at that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their sins and remember their sins, their wickedness no more." Did you hear the language of internalization? The new covenant is one where God will put the law in their mind and write it on their hearts. We all know the difference between being told to do something and wanting to do something, don't we? When we want to do something, it's easy. When we're told to do something, it's often much more difficult. No longer will anyone have to teach anyone else about the Lord because they'll all know me. They'll know me from the inside out. Jesus takes this cup of the Passover and says, "This is my blood of the covenant." Now, blood was often used to formalize covenants because of the serious nature of a formalized relationship. It's kind of like the "till death do we part" piece in marriage vows. Right? It's a serious, serious relationship. But Jesus goes actually one step further, doesn't he? "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." This brings into the scope all of the Old Testament teaching on sacrifice and offering. And there were lots of sacrifices, lots of offerings. A number of them dealt with sin. When the people of Israel broke the terms and conditions of the covenant, it was to be dealt with through the shedding of blood, a ram's blood or a goat's blood or whatever it might have been. And Jesus seems here to take that entire system onto himself. We don't know which offering he has in mind, but we have a bit of a clue. It might be the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement was the most solemn of the festivals of the people of Israel, when the high priest alone went into the most holy place and there made atonement, or covered over, all the sins of the people. All the sins, whether they knew about them or didn't know about them, they were all covered on that one day. When Jesus dies, you might recall the temple curtain is torn in two, and that may very well be the curtain between the holy place and the most holy place, opening access to God. This is what Jesus claims his death is about. It's pretty big, isn't it? Jesus essentially here says that his death is the definitive act of salvation, introducing a new relationship with God, which enables the complete change and restoration of both mind and heart, and the forgiveness of sins, and that what he has done will be sufficient and some for all who require it. Interestingly, we don't have anything from the disciples in terms of their reaction to this. I found that a little bit strange. Perhaps they were just used to Jesus making outrageous comments like this all the time and had just gotten used to it. Or perhaps they were just completely and utterly stressed out of their minds because they just spent a whole week wondering when they were going to die. Every time they went into the temple, Jesus seemed to anger the religious leaders even more so. Maybe they were still trying to come to grips with the fact that Jesus has just said that one of them will betray him. And can I just point out, I think this is really significant. Jesus shares his meal, the broken bread and the cup, which he ascribes to his body and his blood, with people who are about to betray him. The disciples are not the spiritual elite yet. They're not the ones who've got it all together. In fact, Jesus goes on to say that you will all desert me. He says to Peter, you will deny me three times. To that group of people, betrayers and deniers, he says, this is for you. Now, all the way through this series, we've been asking ourselves, what are the implications for following after Jesus? And here we come into a really significant part of the story. This whole series has been premised on two ideas. One, that anyone can begin to follow Jesus. When Jesus first calls his disciples, he does not demand that they believe in him. He does not demand that they have a good understanding of theology or the Bible. He does not demand that they change their lives. All he asks is, are they willing to follow him? That's the first premise. Anyone can begin to follow Jesus. But the second is that the longer you follow Jesus, the sooner you are going to come to a crisis of decision. And the crisis of decision exists because of the sorts of things that Jesus says. Now, you might love Jesus' teaching. You might love the way he treats those who are marginalized, those on the outskirts of society. You might want to emulate those sorts of things, well and good. But Jesus doesn't leave it there. He doesn't just say, I'm a good teacher and I'm a good bloke. He basically says, in my death, I am doing something that has never been achieved before. The definitive act of salvation in which forgiveness and true transformation are found. The provision of God himself to introduce us into a new relationship with God. That's what he claims. And sooner or later, if you have begun to follow Jesus, you're going to have to grapple with that claim. Will you place your faith in Jesus? In what he says about his life? You know, faith in this case is faith in a person. And in that sense, then, faith is not so much what you know, but who you know. We've all had those experiences, haven't we? When we just haven't been able to get the right kind of access to the right sorts of information, and then we call in a favor. We talk to a friend of ours who knows somebody. We bypass the system. We get an in that we didn't necessarily deserve, but we got because of who we knew. Faith in Jesus is essentially saying, I know Jesus. It's about living your life in such a way that people can tell that you know Jesus, and then relying on him to introduce you to God. And relying on him to change your mind and to change your heart. You don't have to be a Christian to know that it's out of our hearts and out of our minds that most of our problems come, where most of what we would call sin comes from, anger, greed, envy, you name it. It's relying on Jesus to forgive our sins, true, deep, profound forgiveness that sets us free from regret and guilt. It's relying on Jesus and his extraordinary provision on our behalf. Some of you might have begun to follow Jesus, and you may be getting closer and closer and closer to that crisis of decision. It sits here. It sits here. And what we hear on Good Friday and what we hear on Easter Sunday, therein lies the point of crisis. But many of us here have decided that we believe who Jesus is. And I want to remind those of you who are in that position that Jesus wants first and foremost followers. Jesus did not call for believers right away. He called for followers. Follow me. And so when we begin to follow Jesus, we do not all of a sudden stop being followers. We must continually place our faith not in what we know or in the sorts of life that we live, but actually to place our faith in Jesus. To remember that it is not about what we know or what we do, but about who we know and about living our lives in such a way that it becomes clear that we know Jesus. This is the meaning of Jesus' death and the ongoing implications for following him.